Jeff Speck has dedicated his career to determining what makes cities thrive, and he's boiled it down to one key factor: walkability. The very idea of a modern metropolis evokes visions of bustling sidewalks and a vibrant pedestrian-friendly urban core. But in the typical American city, the car is still king, and downtown is a place that's easy to drive to, but often not worth arriving at. Jeff Speck has written a new book. It is titled Walkable City: How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. It's published by FSG, and it's a pleasure to welcome Jeff Speck to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Given your work in talking about cities and your book, Suburban Nation, as a city planner, talking about your trials and tribulations, what brought you to this point of boiling it down to walkability being so important?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I was never a walkability guy. I was a designer. First, I was trained in architecture. Then I started doing urban design, found that very quickly turning into a larger city planning discussion and even regional planning. In fact, I worked on a regional plan for Onondaga County, which isn't too far from you. That's the area around Syracuse. And I always thought of things from the design perspective. And like most people, I enjoy walking. But I'd never been that guy. Suddenly, though, I started working with mayor after mayor in a job I had at the National Endowment for the Arts. I was managing a program called the Mayor's Institute on City Design, where every 2 months, somewhere in America, we'd bring together 8 mayors, 8 designers. We'd lock ourselves in a room for 3 days solid, and we'd try to solve. Each mayor would bring their most pressing city planning challenge, and we'd try to solve those problems with the mayors. And it just turned out that case after case, challenge after challenge, and in fact, aspiration after aspiration, what the mayors wanted to achieve in terms of being a competitive city and a successful city, was a walkable city. And so somehow I found, you know, when there were a lot of problems in different places I was working that I couldn't really solve so easily, I found that if I reorganized the discussion around walkability, both from a design perspective, but also from a political perspective, it was much easier to solve these problems.
When you look at it and you write about this, and this is what is so fascinating, you make the point that making walkability happen is relatively easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's relatively cheap. So the obvious question is, what's the rub? Why is it then that it is in many communities a tall order?
You know, I was having this conversation with a sociologist this morning who is writing a paper on the current friction in New York City among the bicyclists and the drivers, because you're probably aware that in Manhattan, and particularly in Brooklyn, a lot of bike lanes have been added, and they're rubbing people the wrong way. And we were talking about how no one wants to give up something they already have, no matter what they have, and the current status quo for most people is the natural situation, right? We tend to naturalize our environment and think that whatever is around us now is the way things have always been, will always be. And it just so happens that in the U.S. for 50 years, we have prioritized the construction of automotive infrastructure at the expense of all others. And so, you know, the typical American street in a city, which has to serve so many functions, you know, not just a place to move cars, but a place to park cars, a place to plant an urban forest, of course, a way to get in and out of buildings, a place to meet your neighbors, a place for dining if you so wish, you know, in pleasant weather, has been that these American streets, the typical downtown American street in America, has lost almost all of its other roles except the movement of cars. You know, the goal is to move as many cars as quickly as possible, and that's been the design mandate for so many years. So, in fact, engineers have looked at our streets in the same way that plumbers look at pipes. And we always joke that, you know, our streets have been turned into automotive sewers because that's the criteria that's been put into effect. But the situation in most American cities is that by hook or by crook, because the the dominant public complaint is about traffic, then the municipal engineers, you know, doing their job, trying to make citizens happy, have been always making quote-unquote improvements to traffic flow at the expense of sidewalk comfort and safety, at the expense of street livability. You know, for example, often removing parallel parking in order to get another travel lane, when people forget that without that barrier of steel, the sidewalk doesn't feel safe. So all these decisions have been made, you know, because there's this understanding somehow that if we improve traffic flow, we will eliminate traffic congestion. And probably the biggest hidden story in the book, and it's been understood now for several decades, but hopefully this book will give it fair play, is this concept of induced traffic. And what we've learned now in study after study is that adding lanes in America only makes traffic worse. And I won't get into all the studies, but the physics behind it or the economics behind it is because we don't pay the full cost of driving, nowhere near it. The smart choice to make when you own a car, when you're already paying for that car, is to drive it as much as possible. And the only real constraint to traffic is congestion. The only thing that's going to stop someone from making a trip in their car once they own the car and are paying for, you know, 4/5 of the cost of car ownership are actually owning the car, and only 1/5 is variable, driving it. So the smart choice at any given time is to drive it as much as possible. And so the only constraint that keeps people at home generally is traffic. And therefore, the only constraint to congestion is congestion. So if you change a street so that there's room for more cars, generally more cars come and take that room, and you end up with just as much traffic, but more lanes of it. So accomplishing the goal of making a street work for everyone is a function of being fair about how we distribute the space among the different users, including the ones who have been kind of marginalized for so long.
Do we learn from things that bring us out of our comfort zone? And I ask the question as a follow-up to Superstorm Sandy and its effect on the city of Manhattan and the boroughs. So you take out, now obviously that's an extreme situation.
Right.
And it puts people into a different mindset of how they have to get to work and how they have to bring their kids to school and how they have to get from point A to point B. But does that allow you to illustrate?
Well, one of the great victories of Sandy, if there are any, or the great, I guess I could say one of the great heroes of Sandy was the bicycle. And so many New Yorkers turned to bicycles that had been, you know, moldering in their basements for many years when they were presented with no more efficient way to get to work, with even the transit system out, right? So I really do suspect that a lot of bikers were minted by Sandy, who realized what a pleasant experience it was, particularly given the new bike lanes that New York has. And they may be permanent bikers, you know, from now on. So we do learn that the bicycle, there's probably been no greater invention in terms of transportation in the history of man than the bicycle. And it is so efficient, so in so many ways, such a pleasure. You know, and if you like biking, one friend of mine joked that it's like being able to golf to work, you know. but the health benefits, obviously the environmental benefits, and then if you live in a walkable city, so I didn't start out as a bike advocate. Now it is my prime way to get around because I live in the kind of city that encourages it, Washington, D.C. But I mean, if you live in a bikeable city, there's actually no more efficient way to run your day. I mean, if I have to get to any appointment by either transit or driving, particularly if you add parking to the driving, anywhere in the city, I've got to give myself at least half an hour to get there. And with my bike, I just have my alarm go off 15 minutes before the appointment, and I am there. It's really amazing. Obviously, there are some drawbacks in terms of weather and sweating and rain, but it's really a tool that it's too bad it takes a disaster to make people realize how valuable it can be. But the general trend, and I don't know the situation in Albany or in the upstate, midstate area in New York, but The greatest revolution currently afoot in most American cities that are having revolutions is about bike use. People are building new bike lanes and minting cyclists. You know, there aren't many things in planning or design which are build it and they will come. But bike lanes has proved itself to be one of those things.
What is your optimism as we wrap up? What is your optimism of bringing all these various interests together to, as your subtitle suggests, how downtown can save America one step at a time? This is a step-by-step process.
It is a step-by-step process. The last point of my 10, so my book Walkable City has the 10 steps of walkability in it. And each is actually a full chapter, and it's quite complex. But the last chapter is called Pick Your Winners. And it's about this concept of what we call urban triage, a term invented by my mentor, Andre Stuani. And what urban triage means is that actually most American cities, even the ones that are considered walkable, is not walkable. Most of most cities is and will remain the auto zone. But most cities, even the ones that have a reputation for being great walking cities, have a small but significant continuous connected core of walkability that in and of itself is either a place you can visit and have a delightful, you know, on-foot experience, or a place you can choose to live, as many, many millennials and empty nesters are choosing to live in this environment in which you're not burdened by the ownership of a vehicle, and have a great, you know, lifestyle in this limited area. And it does not take a lot. Some towns which are famous for being walkable, like, you know, Greenville, South Carolina, just have one great street. So in a city like Albany and other, you know, upstate, midstate New York cities where it doesn't feel like there's much hope, by actually focusing on a few blocks that are the closest as we can get now to being walkable, reinforcing that, connecting the walkable pieces to each other, and making the sort of inexpensive changes that I've been making in a lot of cities, using mostly paint, you know, taking extra travel lanes that aren't needed and turning them into bike lanes, or maybe putting that parallel parking back on the curb, which helps businesses as well as walkers. These little changes are actually quite inexpensive, and if you focus them where they can do the most good, they're surprisingly viable politically.
The name of the book, Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. It is published by FSG. Jeff Speck, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure.
Joe, it was fun for me too.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Walkable City, published by FSG. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.